that's super interesting that it sounds like at least the initial format of the program was based on your training as a theater student. I don't think I would have ever, I think I would have ever guessed that as your source of inspiration.
Yeah. I always say it was more useful than my finance degree.
Broadcasting from the Wharton School, welcome to Start You, bringing you the stories of campus-founded startups from across the nation. In this episode, we're talking with Megan McCormick, founder of Oze, the business analytics tool built for the African business owner. All right, Megan, thanks so much for joining us today. Before we dive deep into your product, Oze, I'd love to get to know you a little bit better. So could you tell me where you're from and if you've always kind of been on this path to entrepreneurship?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk to you today. I am from Villanova, Pennsylvania, which is one of the suburbs outside of Philadelphia. And I went to college at Georgetown University. And I think that, yes, I've always wanted to be an entrepreneur. As like a six-year-old, I would run highly profitable lemonade stands on weekends at the Jersey Shore. I had this great market insight that the people who were buying the lemonade were people who were working out. And so they didn't want to consume a high sugary calorie drink. And so we started selling Crystal Light lemonade on the corner and just funded my middle school and lower school life through those summer ventures. Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. And while you were at Georgetown, were you also focusing on entrepreneurship or starting any sorts of ventures before Oze?
Yeah, at Georgetown, I majored in finance and I minored in theater and performance studies and was really heavily integrated into the arts world. And so I started a for-profit social enterprise called Genesius Productions, which created opportunities for students on campus to perform. Georgetown only had one musical a year, and there was a lot of really talented singers and actors who wanted more opportunities to perform. And then at the same time, we used that group and the money that we made to run after-school arts programs in Anacostia, which is one of the lower-income neighborhoods in D.C.
That's awesome. So just to clarify, you guys would identify other opportunities for performers at Georgetown to perform outside of the school facilities and things like that?
Yeah, so we created our own annual musical review called BAMF, the Broadway Arts and Music Festival.
Nice.
This was back when Glee was first coming on TV, and musical theater was, you know, hitting a level of popularity that we had never seen before. So there was a lot of appetite also on campus for people to see their classmates perform musical theater numbers. So we actually we produced the shows. And we were cash flow positive in year one, which is really rare for arts organizations. Most of them run as nonprofits and rely on donations to actually put on their shows. But from day one, we decided that we wanted to organize ourselves to make a profit so that then we could invest in the after-school opportunities that we want to create.
That's amazing. Wow. So I know that after Georgetown, you went into the Peace Corps, but I'm curious, you know, what made you decide to not pursue the venture that you had been working on at Georgetown further and instead to go into the Peace Corps?
Yeah, so I loved Genesius Productions, but really at that point in my life, I was more in the mindset that I wanted to create something that was student-run and student-led. So I actually passed ownership of the company, passed management of the company down to current students to continue to run, and it survived for a couple of more years, but ultimately we had a really hard time being able to book performance space, and that's what ended up causing the end of Genesius Productions. But I was very passionate about the arts, but I think I was even more passionate about problem solving, and so I wanted the opportunity to really kind of expand the aperture and look what are the problems in the world that I want to start focusing on, that I want to start solving. Growing up in the suburbs and then going to Georgetown, which is a very comfortable neighborhood, I thought that there were problems out there that I didn't know, and I wanted to live them and experience them to become a more empathetic entrepreneur in the future.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So then you went to the Peace Corps, and what did you you know, primarily focus on at the Peace Corps, and where were you stationed, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, so I was in Guinea-Conakry, which is a small country in West Africa, and I was a community economic development advisor. So we're one of the Peace Corps' smallest programs. People don't know that we exist, but it's people with private sector business experience or who had majored in business in undergrad. And basically our mandate was to go improve the economy in Guinea, which Forbes ranked as the worst economy in the world for 4 years running. So I focused on several things while I was there. I actually launched something called Bibliotech, which was the world's second, Africa's first e-reader library, because I found that the donations of books that were coming into Africa actually weren't all that useful for people outside of just learning how to read, and that we wanted to create a resource library for entrepreneurs and for tradesmen so that they could actually expand their businesses and stay on the cutting edge. I also made educational films on the importance of business planning and showing people how they could go about business planning, even if they were illiterate, what kind of resources existed at the village level. And then what I really focused on was launching Dare to Innovate, which was Guinea's first social business accelerator program. At the time, we didn't even know what a social business accelerator was because this was in 2012.
Yeah.
So we just called it a conference. But I had been teaching entrepreneurship kind of all over the country. I taught at a university. I taught illiterate women's agricultural cooperatives. And they would come out of this program, which was really a small business management program with some skills, but really no strong differentiated business ideas and no access to capital. And so Dare to Innovate was created to kind of plug that gap. So what we made was a process based on the foundations of human-centered design and also some practices from participatory theater building and theater creation to lead young people who already had the foundational course done from a problem they wanted to solve in their community all the way through to a market-based solution. At the end of the accelerator, they would return back to where they were from and do prototype testing for about 6 weeks and then come back together again for a pitch competition. And that first year, we gave out $17,000 of seed capital in the form of grants to seven young people who were starting businesses in education, a mobile veterinary clinic, waste management, so kind of across the spectrum of social enterprise. And then from there, we've really grown and expanded. My co-founders are still heavily involved with Dare to Innovate, and it's fully operational in Guinea as well as Benin now, and it's starting to expand into Ghana.
Nice, nice. Yeah, that's really cool. It sounds like Dare to Innovate is you know, somewhat comparable to, I guess, what you would call the standard accelerator format, where you bring in a class and, you know, work with them on whatever problem they're trying to solve and, you know, eventually try to get them to a product. So I'm curious, you know, like, how did you, like you mentioned in 2012, you didn't even know the term accelerator, right? So did you guys just make up like all of this on your own in terms of how to incubate them, or were you taking lessons from YC or Techstars or anything like that? Or how did you basically like format the structure of the program?
Yeah, I relied really heavily on my theater background. So my theater and performance study degree was in new work development for social change. So I would work with people in the community who wanted to start a dialogue around certain issues. So on Georgetown's campus, that was people suffering from depression and exploring the tension between being high performers and having high anxiety. In Anacostia, I would work with these high school students to figure out what problems that were facing their community affected them most strongly. And then we would work together through different activities, different writing exercises, lots of iteration. Theater is a really iterative practice and then kind of end at a finished product. Then you would have audience members who are like customers giving feedback. And if people came to the show, that showed that you were creating something that had value. And so that kind of process really informed the process that we started with Dare to Innovate. The group, there's actually about 8 of us working on it at the time. We came from different disciplines of business. So someone was general management, someone was marketing, I was finance. One woman had started a company before. And so that's where we plugged in the different technical skills. And then we did this, we also used this process called Future Search, which is a participative strategic planning methodology, and wove kind of all of that together, some experiential learning also from Outward Bound, wove all of that together into this program. And kind of right after we ran our first class, that's when IDEO came out with their human-centered design toolkit, and we were like, oh, that's what we did. We created a human-centered design process. And we believe in iteration. So after each class, we collect feedback and we adapt the curriculum. And what the program looks like today, while a lot of the core process are the same, we've wrapped a lot of other products and services around the accelerator. So we do a lot of technical skills building, especially in agriculture right now, and are actually starting to take a stronger hand in planning supply and connecting the supply of our entrepreneurs to demand, both in the local market, but also regionally.
Awesome. Awesome. That's super interesting that it sounds like at least the initial format of the program was based on your training as a theater student. I don't think I would have ever, I think I would have ever guessed that as your source of inspiration.
Yeah. I always say it was more useful than my finance degree.
That's so funny. Okay. So I know that Oze is actually, I think, a product of Dare to Innovate, right? So how did that come to be?
Yeah, so as we expanded from supporting 7 entrepreneurs to 13 entrepreneurs to hundreds of entrepreneurs, we're finding it really hard to know what the health of their business was in real time. So if an entrepreneur was having trouble and we wanted to work with them, that meant one of us getting in a bush taxi, which if you've never been in a bush taxi, they're not very comfortable, driving on broken concrete and dirt roads, sometimes for up to 12 hours, to get to the small business owner. And they would pull out these like giant paper ledger books, and that's where they were recording all of their transactions. And then it was a really laborious process to turn that handwritten data into information that they could use to manage their business better.
Gotcha.
So that was kind of the inspiration. I realized also that a lot of what value that I was adding to these entrepreneurs was helping them do simple calculations and importantly, knowing which calculations I should do and what the outcomes would mean. And that those are all things that a computer can really do. So the first thing that we tried was to send surveys to our entrepreneurs each month to collect data on sales and expenses, challenges that they were having, but pretty quickly found that nobody likes to do surveys. Even when we were Peace Corps volunteers, we had to fill out surveys once a quarter about the performance that we had done and what we had achieved over the quarter. And it would always be kind of like lick your finger, stick it in the wind, and hope that you got somewhere around the accurate number of people that you had worked with and trained. And people were constantly late on filling out these forms. So we gathered as a group, all the original founders of Dare to Innovate, and we actually put ourselves through our own human-centered design process that we use with all of our entrepreneurs. The outcome was a product idea called Impact, which we used to describe as the development industry's first real-time monitoring and evaluation platform. And so our goal was to sell it to organizations like the World Bank or USAID, different implementers, seeing the trend of focusing more and more on small business development and international development and knowing that these organizations didn't have the entrepreneurial or small business sector expertise. But as we got further and further into developing Impact, we realized that the crux of this product was creating something that the small business owner was obsessed with. We needed to meet their needs because if they weren't inputting their data, if they didn't find that activity valuable, then we wouldn't have the data to report back up to the people who are funding the programs. So kind of on each iteration of the product, we stepped further and further away from the development agencies and closer and closer and closer to the small business owner until we realized that we were actually creating something for the small business owner that they themselves would pay for.
Yeah, absolutely. So then how did you manage, you know, once you realized kind of what the product was and who you wanted to serve, how did you manage kind of breaking it out of Dare to Innovate? Like, was it challenging at all to say, hey, we're taking this off independently to develop ourselves, or like, was that not an issue?
Yeah, it wasn't really an issue, because once we started figuring out what Ozé was and talking about it, we found that there was a voracious appetite for a product like this in the market, and that if we wanted to grow it, we were going to need like risk capital. That we really, in order to scale this quickly enough and create a product that was valuable, it couldn't be in a nonprofit model. So everyone agreed that we wanted Ozé to exist, and everyone agreed that Ozé couldn't exist within a nonprofit. Dare to Innovate retained preferred shares in Ozé. So Ozé's success is Dare to Innovate's success. You know, eventually when we're a large company and we're very profitable and we're paying dividends back to Dare to Innovate, that money will all go into a fund that we can then invest in the entrepreneurs that come through Dare to Innovate's programs. The process of spinning Ozé out in terms of separating our systems, separating our people, that's still an ongoing process.
Yeah, but that's really cool that, like you said, Ozé's success is going to be Dare to Innovate's success. So just to get my facts straight, so you came up with the concept for the product, and you built, I'm assuming, a functioning prototype, at least while you were still in Dare to Innovate. So you had a working version of the tool, correct? Like, while you were still with the Peace Corps?
No, so this, after the Peace Corps, I came home and I was a management consultant for 2.5 years focused on innovation strategy, and spent my nights and weekends and all of my vacation time flying back to West Africa, working on Dare to Innovate and starting to develop this idea for Ozé. And when I decided to go to business school, I quit my job as soon as possible so that I had about 5 or 6 months before school started to move back to West Africa and really invest my time behind this idea to see if it could be something that was worthwhile. So at that stage, I created a prototype. My background's not in computer science, so I used Typeform to create a prototype of what, at the time it was still Impact, of what Impact would be. And then I went to entrepreneurs, opened up the Typeform website on their phones, and then downloaded a shortcut to the home screen. So to them, it looked like an app. And so we had entrepreneurs using that for a little while just to test, would people give us data? What was the format? More conversational, more just blank fields? And actually one of the big outcomes of that work was realizing that Guinea and Benin, these are where we were testing it, probably weren't the right markets to launch this product into as our first market, because internet connectivity was still very, very bad at the time. We had users who were on a daily basis trying and failing to be able to even open the Typeform. And smartphone penetration was low. And we didn't want to build a dumb phone app because we know that smartphones are the future. So Jumia just published a report that 95% of the phones sold on their platform last year. Jumia is an African online retailer. 95% of the phones were smartphones. So we learned that we needed to actually seek a different market in West Africa to develop the product. So that's when we did kind of the very basic, like what you would expect an MBA to do, list out all the potential markets. We evaluated them on internet connectivity, the cost of data, cell phone penetration, availability of talent, number of small businesses, and ended up choosing Ghana. Then we went to Ghana with a prototype first we went to Ghana and just did research to see what was different about Ghana and how would this need to shift. So we did a lot of stakeholder research and ran co-creation sessions, again, always using the principles of human-centered design and relying heavily on the same processes that we use with Dare to Innovate. The second time we went back to Ghana, we came with an app that was just a front end, and we gave it out to 26 business owners and wanted to test would people consistently fill out their transaction data in exchange for nuggets of insights about their business. So each day we would download all of the data from the server into Excel spreadsheets. Myself and a couple of colleagues would actually crunch the numbers, run the analysis, and craft the messaging that we wanted to send back. And then in the morning, we would WhatsApp them their analysis from the day before. And then once a week, we would make them a dashboard that we'd make in these PowerPoint slides that we had made to be very long and skinny. Would create their weekly dashboard, compare it to their performance the previous week, save it as a JPEG, and then also send that through WhatsApp, and it looked like a scrolling screen on your phone. And that was that experience over the summer is what really showed us that this app has high potential to be successful, because our users became obsessed with it, and were just dying to get their hands on those dashboards. Really learned a lot. So, you know, for me, the test was, can we collect transaction data? I wasn't even trying to test the second part of, if we provide people with their data, would that improve the management of their business? That's what we were planning on testing at scale kind of now. But even in just a month of using a very low fidelity app, we had users who started executing more effective marketing campaigns. We had users who really started managing and reducing their costs. And we actually had a couple of users who realized that they could create new jobs based on the cash that their companies were bringing in. So that was a really surprising finding, that the low-hanging fruit is very low-hanging, and that this app has the potential both to be a real commercial success, but also make an impact on hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of small businesses.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's interesting that you were able to achieve such a breakthrough and such growth in that, you know, 5 to 6 month gap between, you know, you quitting management consulting and before you start in grad school. So what, just to clarify in my mind, so what were you working on with Oze before you quit your job? Like, you came up with the concept while you were still in the Peace Corps, right? And then you were in management consulting with Doblin. So what were you primarily doing, like building out the design or the concept or an initial prototype for you to test during that 5 to 6 months in that 2 years you were in consulting?
So in the 2 years that I was in consulting, we were really focused on the survival and growth of Dare to Innovate.
Okay.
And we saw this tool as something that could help us scale more quickly. But launching a nonprofit that you want to scale is incredibly difficult. And we had this additional complexity of 1 week before our second cohort was supposed to start, we were still running Dare to Innovate through the Peace Corps. A lot of my co-founders actually extended their service to be our on-the-ground operations. A week before that cohort was supposed to travel to our training center, Peace Corps evacuated from Guinea because of the Ebola epidemic. So for a while there, we were just trying to figure out, would we be able to go back to Guinea? When would we be able to go back to Guinea? At that point, we actually expanded into Benin, also using Peace Corps as our distribution channel. But it was that kind of, like, big influx point. I remember talking on the phone to one of my co-founders about Dare to Innovate. Peace Corps had been evacuated for probably 4 months at that point. And speaking about Dare to Innovate in the past tense, and realizing that that was not the commitment that we made to Guinea. Like, we committed to having Dare to Innovate be something that would last and really change the trajectory of growth in that country and in the region. And so that's when we went to Benin, but that's also, we had a founders retreat. We brought everyone together. It was the first time that all of us were together since we were all Peace Corps volunteers. And that's when we ran this kind of human-centered design co-creation process, put ourselves through our own accelerator. And that's when Impact came out as one of the solutions that we could have in order to operate more effectively, but then also maybe at one point be able to generate revenue from that solution so that we wouldn't be relying on structures like the Peace Corps so that no one could control our destiny and make us evacuate from a country. So then I was focused mostly on Dare to Innovate while I was a consultant. Cash flow issues are really, really hard in these markets. So just around the time that I had gotten into MIT, we had we were probably at about 6 months of no revenue for Dare to Innovate, and people operating on fumes and a small staff of 2.5 paid people. And so that when I went to work on Impact, it was also going back to see, is Dare to Innovate going to survive? What can we do here? And on the day that I left Guinea to come back and start MIT, we signed a big consulting project with the development agency, and that's what saved Dare to Innovate and spurred our growth. But when we were in that period of time thinking, oh, maybe Dare to Innovate isn't a sustainable model, maybe Dare to Innovate can't survive in this market, that's when I started to really think about OSE and think about its potential, because it's something that can survive through the ups and downs of cash flows because it's a digital product. It's not relying on really high-skilled human capital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it sounds like you actually came up with the concept for Impact or OSE in an effort to kind of save Dare to Innovate, at least at first, which is awesome.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, awesome. So fast forward a little bit, and now you're coming into MIT Sloan School of Business, and you're doing a joint degree with the Harvard Kennedy School. Is that correct?
Correct, yeah.
So I guess my first question is, what made you, you know, go back to school and get your MBA and MPP, I believe, instead of going full-time with OSE?
Yeah, so it's an MPA, a Master's MPA, in Public Administration.
My mistake.
OSE was just a little idea at that time, and we definitely didn't have money to pay me, and we definitely didn't have product market fit, and we weren't quite sure what this was going to be. We had applied for and got rejected from Math Challenge, and I saw my experience at MIT to be an accelerator for OSE, to come here for 2 years and actually work with really smart classmates, work with really smart professors, take advantage of the resources on campus to make it so that by the time I graduated, OSE would be raising capital and kind of ready to go. So that is why I came. I think another thing that's specific to being a female entrepreneur, it's really hard for women to raise money. As I'm sure you know, 2% of venture capital goes to female-founded startups. And Africa is a frontier market that doesn't attract a ton of investment capital. And so I knew that if I was just this management consultant who had done the Peace Corps, I maybe would never be able to attract the resources that I needed to make OSE a reality. And if I did, I would have to give up a lot of ownership of the company. And so getting the credentials and the networks of MIT and Harvard were very important to not just starting a small business, but starting something that we believe will scale not just across the continent, but across the developing world. And the support that MIT has given me over the past 2 years is really the reason that OSE is where it is today. So I'm in a fellowship at MIT at the Legatum Center, which is a center focused on entrepreneurship in emerging markets. And for 2 years, they funded pretty much all of my travel back to Ghana, back to Guinea, to work on these companies, as well as kind of a structured learning program around how to work in a really highly resource-constrained environment and still make something that is a profitable business creating social impact. I think MIT has been the world's best business accelerator because I'm about to graduate from MIT, and OSE is exactly where I wanted it to be by this point.
That's awesome. So rewinding a little bit, and you know, your first day at MIT coming in with this product that you know you were optimistic about but unsure of, you know, what were your first steps? You know, how did you navigate the process of getting the support and the resources that you needed, and what did you focus on kind of in the earlier and then the later stages of your time at MIT?
Yeah, so our first semester, like all MBA programs, you have a core. So I didn't have to worry about what classes could I be taking to help the development of OSE. So the Legatum Center really helped me figure out what the resources on campus which ones were there for companies like OSE. So I started at the Legatum Center my first week at MIT, and they really opened up the world of opportunities for me here. Right at the end of my first semester, I won my first pitch competition at MIT, which was great validation. We won the Emerging Markets Prize at the MIT FinTech Pitch Competition. And after getting that validation, I went and spent 6 weeks in Ghana over our Christmas and January vacation, figuring out what the MVP was for OZE, investing some of that money and also being financially supported by the Legatum Center. So it was after that first winter break that I had an idea of what product we wanted to build, and we actually started building it. We actually started writing code. Starting in my second semester, I organized my schedule completely around classes that I thought would be helpful for OZE. So classes like Scaling Entrepreneurial Ventures was taught by, two people who had founded companies that IPO'd, helping you think through what should you be doing now so that you're setting yourself up for growth. But I also took things that wouldn't naturally be intuitive of, this is going to really help you in your business. I took a class called Business Analysis Using Financial Statements because OZE is a business analytics tool and thought, okay, well, I really, really want to know financial statements and I want to know everything that they can teach me. So I took a range of, I pretty much haven't taken a class since I finished the core that wasn't in some way tied to how I could make OZE the most successful product.
So how did you build your team around the product? Like how did you're not from a technical background yourself. How did you acquire the technical talent? I'm assuming some of it was from your time in the Peace Corps and people you were with at Dare to Innovate, but have you been able to, add in any additional team members through, Dublin or your time at MIT?
Yeah. So my co-founder on OZE came from Dare to Innovate. Was the CFO at Dare to Innovate, is now on OZE with me. So we're kind of the core team. In the early days, we would bring mostly computer scientists from MIT on to test feasibility and start building little things. They would come on for a semester or break or summer and recruited kind of people through the MIT network on the computer science side. We have a bias towards hiring in the markets that we work in because we believe that those are the people who have the most insight about what's going to make this product successful. So we really reached outside of the MIT bubble to recruit talent from Ghana and Nigeria. Basically, those two countries represent most of our staff, but still relied on the MIT network in Ghana to figure out where we could post those jobs, where we could find those people. There's a lot of MIT-founded startups working out of the Impact Hub in Accra and Ghana, and so they kind of help us find the talent that we needed. I also had a friend who graduated from MIT last year, and we actually ended up getting selected and getting into Mass Challenge last year, who really set up our business processes and operations, and she knew that she only had a couple of months before she started her job, but she wanted to contribute during that short time. So MIT resources have been great to get punctual things done, but for a longer-term engagement, we really look towards the regions that we work in.
Yeah, yeah. It must be nice having access to some short-term MIT computer science students.
Yeah, nice.
Okay, so how many people are on your full-time team now?
So right now we have four people based in Ghana full-time on sales and on the tech side, as well as a group of part-time quality assurance engineers based in Nigeria. And then there's three of us, Dave, my co-founder, and a woman named Hannah, who's our UI designer, who are elsewhere around the U.S. and around the world. And we're really excited about raising our seed round because that means that we can move our team into Ghana full time and really accelerate our growth.
Yeah, yeah, that must be exciting. So it sounds like, from what you've told me so far, your time at MIT has been, nothing short of miraculous in terms of the support and resources that you've been able to get for OZE. So I'm wondering, what are some of the biggest mistakes or challenges that you've made or encountered along the way, how they taught you, to perform better or differently moving forward. Like, what mistakes have you learned from the most in your time at MIT or before?
Yeah, I mean, I think OSA is the product of being really self-aware of your weaknesses and learning from it. That's how this product was born, and we try to keep that same philosophy in everything that we do. I think a very specific lesson that I learned on early at MIT was that actual connection to the problem and having the feeling that you can't sleep until this is solved is actually exponentially more important than technical skills, because technical skills can be learned, but passion and tenacity can't. Mm-hmm. So early on in our time at MIT, we get really excited because, oh, this brilliant sophomore computer scientist wants to work with us. The contributions would be punctual, things wouldn't be on time. And yes, the code they wrote was brilliant, but we really needed somebody who wanted to run to the finish line with us. So that was one of our big learnings. And now we don't rely as much on pedigree when we're recruiting, but we really focus on the behavioral side of the interview. So our front-end engineer lives in Abuja in Nigeria, not even Lagos, which is the big, vibrant city in Nigeria. He would never get to go to a place like MIT, and yet he's building a brilliant front-end because he steps out of his door in the morning and sees, you know, potential users all around him.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess my next question would be then, you know, just to talk a little bit more about OSA itself, like the product itself. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you guys, or the product, analyzes a small business owner's financial transactions and then provides recommendations or, I guess, insights based upon those transactions themselves. So is that an accurate summary, first of all?
Yes. So I think one of the complicating factors in these markets is that over 95% of the transactions actually happen in cash. So the typical systems that we use in the U.S., like Stripe, they don't work there. And so what you really need to focus on when you're building, what we've really needed to focus on when we're building OSA is how can we make it as simple, easy, intuitive, and almost somewhat addictive to input each and every transaction. So we joke around and we talk about each time you put your hand in your pocket to put money in there or take money out, your other hand better be typing in OSA. And that's something we said a lot in our pilot when we were onboarding people last summer. And when I went back in January, like all of the users, when we reconnected them, were telling me that that reminded them to use OSA. So we're really focused on that user experience. Right now we have it so you just click a giant button and it takes a picture of your receipt, or receipts aren't all that common, so the item that you're buying or selling, and you can put in the amount that you spent right there and then. And you can fill out all sorts of other details that we need to collect then, or we can remind you at the end of the day when you get home to fill in the color. But we want you to take that picture and put that money in right away, because we're geotagging all of our data so that we can create a map of the economic activity going on in the cities that we work in. This is one of the features that we're most excited about, because a lot of what we recognize, a lot of the insights that were useful in the short term that could show immediate impact on our clients was on the cost side. So by geotagging all of these transactions, we'll know if one of our users is paying above average for their area on a certain supply into their business, and exactly where they can go to supply it for less money. So creating really interesting user experiences like that has been a big part. Something that we learned from our users, really the last time we went back during UI testing, that this was a really important feature, was a feature that we call internally I owe them and they owe me. In these markets, small business owners don't have credit cards, they don't have working capital, so they rely on getting really generous payment terms from their suppliers, but they have to give the same sort of payment terms to their buyers. So we have a user, she manufactures sandals, and she'll give a customer a payment terms on a single pair of flip-flops. So now when people put in transactions, they can mark them paid, unpaid, or partially paid, put the person who they owe money to or who owes money to them, put their name, their phone number, a due date, and set a reminder. And so our users want that feature so desperately now in the short term that they'll continue to use Ozay in the beginning until we have enough data to give them really valuable insights. So we're creating stickiness on the product even before being able to really transform their business with the data that we're presenting back to them.
Gotcha. So it sounds like there's two sort of micro products there, and that the IOU and You Owe Me and the I guess just transaction recording features.
Yeah, so we are a business analytics platform, but we think that, or we know that financial reports are an externality of collecting the data that we need to do the business analysis.
Right.
So we also are a record-keeping app. And we are a freemium model because we need to create this massive crowdsourced database. And so people just using our free app, they can use it as a record-keeping app and get really light rules-based analysis as well as dashboards. And those who want more expert analysis, more in-depth analysis, as we build our data site, who want analysis generated by artificial intelligence as well as their financial statements, they will convert to the premium version of the app. So really it is both record keeping and business analysis.
Gotcha. And have your users, expressed interest or willingness to, to pay extra for the premium services? Or have you really not been able to kind of showcase that functionality yet to the point where they even know what they'd be buying?
Yeah, so the willingness to pay was actually much, much higher than we even anticipated. We originally said we're going to go into market as a free app and just monetize the data. And our user said to us, no, like, we want to pay for this. Like, we wouldn't trust it if it was free. So there is a willingness to pay there. I think one of the main carrots we have to convert people to premium is a feature called Investment Ready. So we're tracking your business performance over time. We're seeing how it's growing. We're seeing how coachable you are. And in parallel, we're working with financial institutions to figure out what kinds of behaviors and key performance indicators they want to see in a small business before they'll give them a loan or invest in them. Mm. And so if you convert to premium and you hit the KPIs and behaviors that make you investment ready, then we are creating an enterprise-level platform for the financial institutions, and we will share your financial statements directly with these financial institutions, who can then chat back with you and give you a loan that's appropriate for your growth rate and your level of risk and what you'll be able to pay back. So that's a huge carrot to convert to the premium side.
Yeah, not to mention, I would imagine that, those financial institutions themselves might be potential customers of the service as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. So just in terms of, the milestones you've been able to hit, I'm curious, how much funding that you've been able to acquire through your time at MIT or other investors or, different mentors or advisors that you've been able to bring on to Ozay, just some of your key milestones, I guess I'd say.
Yeah, so we've been running super lean off of prize funding from pitch competitions.
Nice.
So this is both at MIT, we just won the Accelerate round of the MIT 100K pitch competition. That was $10,000. At the beginning of the year, we won Wharton's new venture competition at their Africa Business Conference, which was $10,000. So that supplemented with MIT has something called the Sandbox Fund, where teams over their 2 years, or I guess if they're an undergrad, 4 years at MIT, can get up to $25,000 of grant funding into their business. So we've gotten $21,000 from the MIT Sandbox Fund so far. And then the Legatum Center and other public service centers on campus have supported my travel and my living expenses while I'm working on Ozay over breaks and over the summer. In terms of advisors here, it's like you're at an advisor buffet at every moment. So depending on the specific issue that we're having with our business, we go pick a certain person that we want to talk to. Because we're very much in the entrepreneurship community at MIT, I already know all of the entrepreneurs in residence here. I know the faculty are focused on entrepreneurship. And so when I have a question or a challenge, I know who I can turn to get that kind of support.
Awesome. So, you know, looking ahead, I mean, I know that I think you guys were targeting to launch the product to public users, I think, potentially
very
in March.
Soon.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or very soon.
So,
I'm just wondering what's coming down the pike. Like, what are your plans for the next, 3 to 6 months?
Yeah. So right now we're just doing some testing on the app. And as soon as that testing is done, we will launch a closed beta in Ghana. And then based on what we learned during that period that we're in the closed beta, that will decide when we launch and how aggressively we spend behind the launch. We hope to scale up in Ghana this year. Our goal is to get 10,000 users on the app in the first year after our launch, and then start looking to other markets like Nigeria, where there's a massive opportunity. So that's kind of the timeline. And we have our product roadmap, so we're constantly in parallel working on developing the new features that we want to add to the app, doing some research on the enterprise side to start building out that product. So a lot of exciting things in the product development space. And then really just trying to embed ourselves into the entrepreneurial ecosystem in Ghana so that we can start to recreate what we've had here as our cocoon at MIT, but then also turn back and be really strong contributors. We want the OZE brand to stand for trust, and we want OZE to be the place that every small business turns to for their needs. So for us, this business analytics record-keeping app is just our first product. We intend to expand kind of horizontally, becoming the hub for small business solutions across the emerging world. So we're really focusing as well on brand building.
Yeah, all that sounds amazing. Okay, well, thanks so much for speaking with us. I guess the last thing I would just ask you is, what advice do you have for others? What advice do you have for aspiring entrepreneurs such as yourself who, you know, may not necessarily know what their quote unquote idea is, or may have something that they're already set on and are trying to, you know, pursue further? What would you tell them?
I think that every frustration is a business opportunity. And so live your life looking for what's bothering you and how you can make it better. And if you're not the core user for the solution that you're building, get to know those users incredibly well. If I didn't live in a hut with a Ghanaian family off the grid, living and working and buying from small businesses for 2 years, I never would have been able to create a product like OZE. So read up on human-centered design, learn co-creation processes, and treat your early adopters as if they're members of your team.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you so much, Megan. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.